This is North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Phoebe Judge. Cases of Ebola are on the rise in Western Africa. The World Health Organization has reported 330 deaths, and the number is climbing. Dr. William Fisher is a professor at UNC School of Medicine and just returned from Guinea, the epicenter of the latest Ebola outbreak. He went at the request of the World Health Organization, and when he arrived, he started sending emails back to his family to report on what he was seeing. He joins me now to talk about this all. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with you reading one of these emails that you sent back to your family.
Sure. So this was part of an email that was sent on June 3rd, 2014. Each day has its bright and dark moments. There are two people in the treatment center that are improving. One is a young man who started helping us encourage the other people in his room to drink more and to keep fighting. It's inspiring, to say the least. The other is an older man who claims to be 35, but is more likely 85, and every time I walk into his room, he acts like he's doing calisthenics. It provides a moment of levity against all of the struggle that defines the isolation zone. Unfortunately, we also have an 18-year-old woman who is 5 months pregnant, has Ebola and malaria. I thought being 18 was tough. I can only imagine being pregnant, infected with a near uniformly fatal virus, having malaria, and being in an isolation zone treated with people in spacesuits. The clinical course of pregnant women with Ebola is not good, to say the least. And unfortunately, she began having contractions overnight, and we helped her, quote-unquote, deliver a non-viable fetus this morning. Miserable.
So I think that most of us have heard the word Ebola before and associate it with a terrible virus, and as you say, a uniformly fatal virus. Just describe what we're talking about when we talk about Ebola.
It was first recognized in 1976 in what was then Zaire, and now has sporadic outbreaks throughout mostly Africa. People often present with sudden onset of fever, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and about 50 to 60% of them can actually experience a hemorrhagic conversion where they start vomiting blood or having blood in their diarrhea as well.
And you mentioned that there are sporadic outbreaks of Ebola. One of these outbreaks is going on right now, a very serious one, it seems like, in Western Africa.
That's right. This is an incredibly complex outbreak, in fact, because the epicenter, which is actually Gekadu, which is a village in Guinea.
Where you were.
Which is where I was, located, is located right at the intersection of three different countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. And what makes this, and this is an incredibly complex outbreak from a geopolitical perspective, because people and illnesses are able to cross these boundaries between countries fairly easy, but resources and organization and aid efforts are not. And so there's been incredible spread amongst these three countries, which has led to a difficulty in controlling the outbreak.
You work at UNC Hospital, which I think no one would argue is a world-class hospital. And then you are dropped off in this village in Guinea. What was your first reaction when you landed and looked around at where you were?
So if I could actually start maybe a week earlier, because I think there's something that's important that's often not talked about is the fear of Ebola and fear of going into an outbreak like this.
Because it's incredibly contagious.
It's incredibly contagious. It's associated with an incredibly high mortality rate. I'll tell you that the fear was almost paralyzing. So the few days that I was in Geneva prior to leaving for Guinea, we were trying to figure out if I was going to go or if I wasn't going to go, and we were trying to get enough time to allow my vaccinations to take effect. I was almost overwhelmed with fear to the point where I told one of the people at WHO that if they don't get me on a plane in 24 hours, that I'm going to think myself out of this equation, because I was concerned about being ineffective. I was concerned about, because like you said, I don't have many of the resources or any of the resources that I'm used to at a place like UNC. But once I got there, I was immediately calmed down by a couple things. One is the recognition that that it's not like the movies. That blood is not coming out of every orifice in the majority of patients. But also, I was comforted by the structure that was in place, created by Doctors Without Borders and the International Red Cross. They had created a structure that allowed us to not focus on ourselves and to really focus on delivery of care to the people who needed it the most.
It still must have been a very difficult sight to walk into.
There is something particular about Ebola. The way that it isolates sick patients from their families, I think, is particularly difficult. You know, in the U.S., when you get sick, you have the comfort of of a human hand. You have the comfort of your family nearby. With Ebola, we've, out of necessity, have to eliminate that personal touch because there's a potential for ongoing spread. And I think for me, that was something that made this incredibly difficult.
Because you're wearing protective suits in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. So part of the structure that provides us some sense of safety is incredibly limiting. So we were wearing medical scrubs, rubber boots that come up to our knees, and then a impermeable Tyvek suit that covers those boots, covers our arms, covers our entire body. We have a impermeable hood that covers our entire head and neck and ears, everything. So you can imagine if you're a child or even if you're an adult, it's an incredibly frightening experience to see this person walk in what amounts to essentially a spacesuit, in addition to being sick. One little boy, I think, was one of the hardest patients for me to see. He was a nine-year-old little boy who had been locked into a house with his mother because his mother had displayed symptoms. She had previously participated in a burial and had washed the body, as is custom there, and you know, did not have the resources of barrier protection that would have prevented transmission. Became infected and likely infected her son, and they were locked into a house for about 4 days because people were so scared about this virus. They were so scared about spread, and finally, when we found out about them and able to get to them, they were transported in the back of a pickup truck to the treatment center. And unfortunately, only the boy was admitted that night because the mother died. So that boy was transported in the back of a pickup truck along this dirt road next to his dying mother. And when he got there, he was by himself in a treatment center, being cared for people in this, you know, in this spacesuit. And it was probably one of the most difficult things for me to see. Not just the disease, not just the vomiting, the diarrhea, but the despair that was present, you know, from having seen his mother die, from being surrounded by us foreigners, and just being alone. And he came with barely a pulse, we aggressively resuscitated him. We gave him a lot of fluids. We gave him antibiotics. We tested him for malaria, and we were able to get his pressure back. So we got actually a palpable pressure, which was, it just felt like a chance. I gave him a little package of cookies, and I was trying for anything, and I actually got a little bit of a smile out of him, but it was he was in a tough spot. And then we had to leave. We had to leave because the amount of time that we could stay in the isolation zone was limited by this protective equipment, which was, you know, also necessary. But we left with this sliver of hope, this sliver of a chance that we thought we could get him through this. And that night he started vomiting blood and died on his own in an isolation ward without his family. You know, you sit there and you tell yourself that, well, he had this hemorrhagic conversion. You know, the chances of us being able to get him through this are pretty low. But it's miserable. It affects you in every sense of the way. It feels like you're a failure.
So what happens next? From all the reports, Ebola is continuing to spread in parts of Western Africa, and not just Guinea, as you mentioned, a number of different countries.
So what happens next is that we have got to continue to contribute resources, personnel, to improve the care of infected patients, and to try to gain the trust of local communities, and to try to facilitate people being identified as sick and earlier in their course of illness, so that you have a better chance of having a good outcome. This is not insurmountable. Ebola, it's incredibly terrifying, but it can be controlled with a minimum of resources. I mean, it's really about infection control. It's really about education. It's really about preventing transmission.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Phoebe, thank you so much for having me. This is a real honor.
Dr. William Fisher is an associate program director in the Department of Pulmonary Medicine and Critical Care Medicine at UNC. You can read more of his dispatches from Guinea on our website, wunc.org. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.